All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Well, good afternoon. I am Jim Fossone with Veterans Radio. I'm officer of the deck today, Lieutenant JG type. Glad to be here on WAM 1600 Talk Radio to bring you a couple of great interviews from Veterans Radio. Most of us know that the percentage of veterans who receive medical care from the VA hospital is small, and many veterans don't get all of their care, even if they get some of it, at a VA hospital. So many veterans struggle with medical debt. And one of the things we're going to talk about today is an organization, national organization, that deals with this question of medical debt for veterans. So I think you'll find that of interest. In our second interview today, we'll talk with Sean McFate, a pretty smart guy, PhD type, a Army veteran, who will talk to us about his views on the changing rules of war, who's waging it, why they're waging it, and those sorts of issues. Very fascinating. You actually might find it a little disturbing. I certainly did, because I hadn't thought about it this way before. So I think you'll want to stick around for that. And certainly we want to, at the top of the show here, thank our sponsors. We're, as I said earlier, we're glad to be on WAM 1600 here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But the Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310 support us, as does the American Legion Post 46, the VFW Post 423, and U.S. Wings, which provides great products to veterans and has since 1986. And you can visit their online store, which has got a lot of fascinating things. And our friends at LegalHelpForVeterans.com, the veterans disability lawyers here locally. So glad to have all those sponsors. We want to encourage you to sit back and listen to the entire show here on WAM 1600, because I think you're going to find both interviews with these gentlemen very fascinating. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Michael Burrows, who is the Director of Military Debt Acquisitions and Relief for RIPmedical.org. Michael, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, and my pleasure to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
Well, let's set up for our Veteran Radio listeners a little bit about who you are and why this is a passion of yours. As I understand it, you did your bachelor's degree at Illinois State University and your master's through the U.S. Army War College. You retired out as a colonel in the U.S. Army. But tell us a little bit about your decades of service and some of your military background.
Absolutely. Well, basically served from 1975 up to 2012, 37 years, 9 years enlisted, 28 years commissioned, and that was a combination of active duty, deployments, the Illinois Army National Guard, and the United States Army Reserves. And I was fortunate enough to be deployed in 2005, 2006 to Iraq, and had a great successful mission there, and came back and finished setting up a sustainment brigade, the 89th Sustainment Brigade out of Wichita, which I moved to Belton, Missouri. Had that for 4 years, and it's really unheard of to have a brigade for 4 years, but just started out with two people, me and the command sergeant major, and we built it into a viable unit. And that's when I said, hey, you know what, it's time for me to retire after 37 years and let some of these young majors and lieutenant colonels move up and get promoted. So it was a great career. I enjoyed it.
And tell us a little bit about what brought you initially into the Army, first as an enlisted and then the conversion over to the officer ranks.
Well, basically, at age 17, really wasn't headed anywhere. I think that's the story for a lot of us young men. And so I got the parents to sign off The other thing that motivated me is my dad was a Korean War veteran, Purple Heart recipient, fought with the 25th Infantry Division in Korea. And his twin brother spent 27 years in the Air Force, and his older brother served in the Pacific during World War II. So I was motivated by family and just inspired. And so that's what I wanted to go and do. And after spending 9 years enlisted, I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to get out there, and I knew I had leadership qualities and leadership ability, and I wanted to lead, and that's what I got the opportunity to do. It was a great career.
Well, I think many folks that we talk to and who are listeners to Veterans Radio have some of that same background, that they have a family history of service, so it's something that's viewed very positively in their family when they're growing up. And they can look at some role models. And oftentimes we hear the same thing. Hey, I graduated from high school. I didn't have any direction. And right after that, I get to say to the somebody like you, Mike Burrows, I bet you had a lot of direction after that first few months in the Army.
Yeah, Fort Leavenworth really kind of knocked me back into shape there in January of 1975. So, yeah. but you know what? I enjoyed it. I went in there after playing football for 4 years in high school, and I think I weighed about 190 pounds. And I come out of there about weighing 150, and man, did they work me. But it was good. It was all worth it. And I'd recommend it for any young man or young woman today that you know, if they're really looking for the discipline and they're looking for a calling to serve their country, go for it.
And you had the opportunity to have a private sector career as a result of your time in the reserves. Tell us a little bit about your private sector career.
Well, it's kind of unique because as of this year, I've spent 40 years also in the credit and collection industry while serving. And I've been the president and CEO of two major companies. I've owned my own debt buying company. And as a result of meeting some unique individuals on Rally Point, which I'm a member of as well, I ran into Jerry Ashton, who is the co-founder of RIP Medical Debt, who is also a veteran. And he said, man, he goes, I love what you're doing, from my LinkedIn profile, because at the time I was working for two other nonprofit organizations, Victory for Veterans and the National Veterans Transition Service, a.k.a. Reboot. And he looked at my private background in the debt buying industry, and he said, hey, you're exactly what we need. And so my relationship with debt buyers and buying healthcare debt in the past was a great fit for me with RIP Medical Debt, plus my wanting to help veterans. So it was a great fit.
Well, before we get to RIP Medical Debt, let's back up, because you mentioned it, and we haven't talked about them in a long time here on Veterans Radio. And we're talking to Mike Burrows, Director of Military Debt Acquisitions and Relief for RIP Medical Debt. But, Michael, talk a little bit about the Rally Point connection, what Rally Point is and how it kind of connected you to this new passion of yours.
Well, as of January, I've been on Rally Point for about 5 years. It is a veteran blog or membership that allows many veterans to connect. And like I said, I've been on there for 5 years, and I happen to be the number one influencer on there, believe it or not. I do an inspirational, motivational quote there every morning through Victory for Veterans Foundation blog. Posted out there. I've got probably close to almost 18,000 followers that I've connected with. And it's allowed me to help veterans on one of my other missions, and that is Sunday evenings I do a video conference called Warriors for Life, and I connect with veterans that have PTSD, TBI, MST, addictions, and other disabilities. And I've been doing that for 3 years, and I'd like to think that we've really created a community group support, not to replace the VA. It's just something in addition to the VA. And these veterans and me meet every Sunday night, and now we're doing it Wednesday nights. And we talk about, you know, what's working, what's not working, and we just provide support for each other, and we've really built a strong friendship, and we're hoping to grow that as well. So that's what Rally Point's done. I've been able to connect with a lot of these individuals that are hurting or suffering from PTSD or TBI, and they need a friend. They need somebody they can trust. And with my military background and being the number one influencer, that trust is there, and the connections have been made. So it's been pretty awesome.
Well, and as I say, we haven't talked about Rally Point here on Veterans Radio in quite a while, actually. And so it's great to bring it back to the focus for folks. And for those of you veterans or friends of veterans who are listening and say, well, I still don't get what Rally Point is, you can think of it as a LinkedIn for the veteran community, if you're familiar with that platform. I don't want to relate it really to Facebook because that's got all kinds of goofiness. So I think that the purest comparison maybe on the civilian side might be something more like a LinkedIn where you connect and profile with people. So, Michael, we talk about your background and your involvement with veterans groups so that people can understand the credibility that you're going to bring to this next topic we're going to talk about, which is a little unusual. So let's back up and talk about RIP medical debt. What does RIP medical debt do?
Well, it's a 501c3 charity, okay, that was established by Craig Antico and Jerry Ashton. Jerry Ashton being the Navy veteran. And both of those gentlemen come from the collection industry. So in their past, you know, they were out there collecting debt, you know, for healthcare providers and, you know, and other, services. And, they got together with, a group, in Wall Street. And, I can't remember the name of the group, but, they met there in Wall Street, and they got together with that group and they said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could go out and we could abolish, you know, healthcare debt? You know, how difficult would that be? And so this group got together with Craig and Jerry based on their past experience and said, hey, how can we do this? And so they put their heads together and they were able to raise enough money to abolish about, you know, $70 million in debt. And the group decided to move on to something else. And Craig and Jerry said, well, wait a minute, you know, this is pretty cool. You know, we've got a real healthcare problem here in the United States, you know, which, it's unbelievable. I mean, the billions of dollars that we have in unpaid medical debt out there. And Jerry said, well, yeah, I'd like to do it for veterans. And Craig said, well, I'd like to do it for civilians. So they created RIP medical debt. And, since they've started, at the end of 2018, we just got done abolishing over $500 million in healthcare debt for veterans and civilians. And out of that $500 million, $60 million of it has just been dedicated towards veterans. And, you know, that's the important piece for me. I'm working both sides. I'm helping negotiate the purchase of that debt at a very, very, very low rate. So we get a 1-to-100 ratio for all of our donors.
So let me stop you here.
Yeah.
So what you guys do because of your industry experience is you go out to people who hold that medical debt and they're holding it over the heads of Americans and are, you know, I'll use the word hounding them to pay off this old debt. But what you guys go do is buy that debt from those, I guess, credit agencies or companies, and then you just wipe it out.
Yeah, we abolish it. We make it go away. So basically what we're doing through my past experience, I've got about 12 years in the debt buying arena of healthcare. I think over my tenure in that space, I have bought probably close to around $2.5 billion worth of the healthcare debt. And so I had a good relationship with some of the major healthcare debt buyers. And so we reached out to them, and then based on qualifications, we just don't abolish debt for anybody, but based on the fact that if they're a veteran, based on the fact if they're two times the poverty level or above and below, or if 5% of their gross income is going towards paying for health care, or if they're just underwater, you know, based on certain attributes, you know, in their in their credit history, we go out and we find this debt and we purchase it, you know, for anywhere, you know, for a penny on the dollar, okay, and then we abolish it. And the great thing about it is, all of the money that we raise to abolish this debt, or 75% of it's private donors. These are people around the United States that really love our mission. NBC, TV stations across the nation have stepped up, and some other companies and churches have stepped up. They love what we're doing. And so we've grown from 300,000 in contributions back in 2016 to over 5 million and donor contributions here in 2018.
It's a crazy idea, but it takes an industry insider like you guys are to know how this works and to understand that there's a way to eliminate this debt. You just got to you buy it cheap and then you just forgive it. When you forgive it, is there a tax consequence to the individual? Is there a do they have to pay something to get you to forgive it? How does it happen?
Well, first of all, we don't do it on an individual level. I want to make sure that your listeners understand that. It's very difficult to do anything on an individual level. We do it as a random act of kindness. And we reached out to the IRS, and they said, because you are a charity and because you are forgiving this debt, it's a gift. So there's no 1099 requirement to the individual that we forgive this debt for. So there's absolutely no tax responsibility. So if you get one of our yellow envelopes with RIP Medical Debt logo on the left-hand corner and you open it up and it says we just gave you a gift and we abolished X number of dollars of health care, it's your lucky day.
It really is. I mean, and medical debt, I see from your website, something like over 60% of the bankruptcies in the U.S. are caused by medical debt. People file for bankruptcy due to medical debt more than anything, even more so than, you know, college costs. So, I mean, it's medical debt can be crushing on people. And a lot of folks think, and this is where the mistakes come in, right? A lot of people think, well, you're a veteran. Every veteran gets their health care at the VA hospital, don't they? And indeed, that's not the case. So talk to us a little bit about, as a retired colonel, as somebody who's really worked and is passionate about working with veterans, tell us about medical debt and veteran status.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you bring up a great point. I mean, just think about individuals that go out there that have a disability rating and they go to apply, and the process to apply, and really nothing against the VA, it's just, you know, we're dealing with the government, right? And some of these individuals incur health care debt before they even get their VA disability, okay? And you got to remember that the individual that served is the only one that's getting those VA benefits if they do get them right away. And there's been denials. And some of those denials sit in the appeal process for anywhere from a year to 2 years to 3 years, kind of going back and forth, you know, to put the documentation together. In the meantime, that veteran is incurring medical debt, okay, for things that might have occurred on active duty, or prior to active duty or after active duty. And then you got the family, right? So the member who served, yeah, he might be getting the VA benefits, but what about the wife and what about the children? And that's really what we're looking at. We're looking at the member himself, and we're looking at his entire family. And if that wife doesn't have a great job, provides health care insurance, that veteran can be underwater in one day with massive health costs, okay? I mean, just take, for instance, passing a kidney stone, right? If the veteran is still going through the process of trying to get his benefits and he has a kidney stone and he's got to go into the emergency room and he runs up a $20,000 bill, which is very, very likely, okay, when you're passing the kidney stone and you go to the emergency room, right? Because they're going to look at a lot of things. They're going to do a CT scan, you know, they're going to get an IV on you. And what's he going to do with a $20,000 bill? Let's say that individual is just an E5, right? And he's applied for 100% disability. His monthly check is not going to help him get out from underneath that $20,000. And before you know it, it's in collection, it's on his credit report, and that family is hurting.
We see it here at my law firm working with veterans with disabilities where, yeah, maybe they can treat for one problem at the VA, but other medical problems, they have to have a private practice or a private hospital, or they're not close to their VA doctor when something happens and they end up in an emergency room. It just really rolls up on folks pretty fast, and if they're not, I mean, it's just hard to understand all the insurance rules nowadays anyway, let alone right. Also, those rules as they apply at VA or TRICARE with private sector interfacing. So I can really understand how people find themselves upside down on these problems. But, Michael, how do they reach out to RIP Medical Debt for assistance, or do you guys just scrub and look for veterans inside the data that you get from buying up old debt from collection agencies?
Well, I mean, you kind of hit it on the nail there at the end of it. So when we get access to, when we partnered with some of these large debt buyers, currently today we have access to almost $4 billion in healthcare debt for civilians and veterans. And we go out and we've got a service, a group in New York that goes out and does this RCA, Soldiers Relief Civil Act Search, which can go out and check to see if a veteran has been discharged or is currently serving. So we can find out if they're still active. We can find out if they've been in the Reserve, the Guard, Air Force, any one of the services. And we pay for that service, you know, ourselves, and that's how we go, and that's how we find our veteran debt. But what we're doing now is we're starting to reach out directly to healthcare providers. And I think that's important for your listening audience, especially if they have connections with hospitals and major healthcare groups. We're reaching out directly to the hospitals now, because, you know, there's only so many debt buyers out there, and this is a huge problem. And we're reaching out to the healthcare providers, to these major hospitals and healthcare groups, and saying, hey, guys, if you give us access to your data, we will search to find out whether or not you have veterans or active duty service members or part of their family, you know, within your accounts receivable. And we'll be willing to pay you a fair market price for that so we can go out and we can help those individuals and abolish that debt, okay? And again, like I mentioned before, Jim, it's done on a random basis. We have hundreds of people calling in every day, telling us about their debt and telling us about their problems. We just haven't solved the issue of doing it at the individual level because everything that we do is donor driven. Okay? So when a donor comes to us, they might come out of the state of California. We had a large donor in Los Angeles come to us who gave us $15,000, and we were able to abolish $1.5 million in veteran debt just there in the LA County and surrounding area. But it was done randomly. Okay. So that's the important thing. We continue to wrestle with how do we do it on an individual basis. A little bit more difficult because when you get the individual, that calls in and says he has healthcare debt, it could still be with the creditor. Okay.
Right.
And it could be early on in the process, or it could still be with the collection agency, or it could be going through litigation. You know, and that makes it a little bit more difficult to buy the debt at a very, very low price that we're buying it at now.
So let me, before we run out of time, I want to make sure folks who are inspired by this, these random acts of kindness, particularly for our veteran population, tell us how folks can learn more about RIP medical debt, and more importantly, maybe how they might be able to donate, because I suspect every dollar is needed in this project.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the quickest and the fastest way is the same way that you did it, is going out to our website, going out to www.ripmedicaldebt.org. Going out to that website, there's a couple links on there that will for donors, and there's a couple links in there where they can, you know, kind of talk about their own personal story, and there's a lot of great information out there. That's really the most common way to do it. It's right there on the website.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to point out on that website is you've got ways for people to get involved, whether they want to start a local campaign or if it's a corporation that wants to do this. RIP Medical Debt will help and assist you in those kinds of efforts, so you can pool your local efforts, maybe through your church, maybe through your veteran service organization, maybe through your company, to help extinguish as much, you know, raise as much money as you can to help extinguish as much debt. So I think that's a fantastic way for people to go. Michael Burrows, Director of Military Debt Acquisitions and Relief for RIP Medical Debt. And would you give that website one more time?
Yes, sir. It is www.ripmedicaldebt, all spelled out, one word, .org/contact/. So if they go to that site, we've got an entire development team, okay, an entire development team that will work with churches. They worked with the MBC affiliates across the country. They work with corporations. They work with private groups, and they work with private donors to set up campaigns on a regional basis, geographically, or nationally. And they can do it for veterans, and they can do it for civilians. So as far as I know, Jim, we're the only ones out there doing this, and I think this is a great mission.
Well, it is a great mission, Michael, and I want to thank you for taking some time to explaining it to our Veterans Radio audience today. I think people are often looking for something that they can do that they know will impact specific veterans. Maybe it's your church group, maybe it's your VSO, maybe it's a civic club that you're involved in. I want to encourage you to give some thought to whether or not you could raise funds for RIP medical debt and help extinguish the crushing debt, medical debt that many veterans have. So hope you enjoyed the interview and think about whether or not you can help out. After the news, we'll bring you an interview with Sean McFate.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. We want to thank our sponsors again, Legal Help for Veterans, whose ad you just heard. But we also want to thank U.S. Wings. They've been a great sponsor this season. You should go to uswings.com to review the jackets, clothing, accessories that they make for veterans. Great quality stuff, reasonable price, and we can't say enough good things about what they have on their online store, uswings.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Sean McFate. He's wrote a recent book called The New Rules of War, Victory in the Age of Durable Disorder, and this is a fascinating read. Dr. McFate, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you. It's really great to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have somebody who is an author, a foreign policy expert, an academic, a novelist, somebody who carries all those hats. But maybe let's start with some of the more important things. You were an Army veteran. Tell us a little bit about your Army career.
Yeah, I was in the 82nd Airborne Division. I was a paratrooper. I had the privilege of serving under then my battalion commander was Lieutenant Colonel Stanley McChrystal, and my brigade commander was David Petraeus, Colonel Petraeus. And that was a lot of fun, a lot of ruck marching, some tough conversations, but I learned a lot from them. It was great.
Well, one of the things you get an opportunity to do when you're in the military is get surrounded by some really quality people and deep thinkers. Did they help kind of push you along the way? You got out of the military and ultimately ended up in the academic world. Was there a nudge by them in that direction?
There was, and actually I capture it in this book, The New Rules of War. There was a time when we had done, I was in 2504 1st Brigade in the 82nd. We'd done a mass attack one night in Sicily drop zone and took the whole brigade sort of, you know, parachutes onto the drop zone. And then we do our exercise and, you know, seize the objective. And I run into a soldier randomly, and it turns out to be the brigade commander, David Petraeus. And we had this, like, really surreal brief conversation at dawn with, like, haze around us. And he's like, you know, he told me this is the 1990s, early 90s, saying that the future of war is not going to be conventional. It's going to be insurgency. And the U.S. military is not ready for it. And you need to get out and get a PhD and think about this. Strengthen your mind, is what he told me. And so I did. And Stan McChrystal wrote me a recommendation, and I, long story short, it was not a direct route, but I ended up going doing a PhD, and now I'm writing about it, and this is sort of what the book's about.
Well, let's back up on your academics. You got your bachelor's from Brown University, your master's in public policy from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and as you mentioned, a PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics and Political Science. So you really have the chops, the academic chops, to be a deep thinker in this area of national security and strategy. And currently you are a professor of strategy at the National Defense University and Georgetown University School of Foreign Service in Washington, D.C., but you also have spent some time at a number of think tanks, one in particular, RAND Corporation. We talk to their researchers regularly and get very interesting information out of them. Tell us a little bit about your think tank experience.
Well, I've worked at four. I've worked at the RAND Corporation. I've worked at New America Foundation. I've worked at something called the Bipartisan Policy Center and also the Atlantic Council. And everyone is different. And Washington has its own sort of strange think tank landscape that is mysterious to people outside the Beltway. Think tanks are interesting. They are, in some ways, they are thought leaders. In other ways, they're kind of like lobbyists for certain things, for policies. And it helps you to understand how, you know, D.C. is like a black box. You see what goes in, you see what comes out, and you're like wondering what on earth happened in between. And being involved in the think tank, well, I got to be around some very smart people who are a lot of fun, and it also kind of filled out what goes on in that black box sometimes.
Well, one of the things I also want to back up to, because I don't want our veteran radio listeners to think you are just a egghead. And so we did, we talked about your military career, but also fascinating because it seems to me it influences the book. Maybe you'll tell us it didn't, but I think it did. You spent time as a private military contractor. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can. So I left the military and I went to Harvard for my master's degree. And the first semester there, I was convinced I made the worst mistake of my life. And I was doing, like, problem sets for economics. I wanted to study warfare. I was like, this is really boring. And then I got a phone call from a company that basically went something like this. We don't know, you know, you don't know who we are, but we know who you are. And we really want you to drop out of your graduate program to come to Africa and raise a small army. And I was like, done, sign me up. Now, it may have helped that I was, you know, in the middle of doing midterm exams and wasn't feeling happy about that. But I dropped out of Harvard, and I spent three or so years mostly in Africa, not Iraq, not Afghanistan, mostly in Africa, also somewhat in Eastern Europe. I was raising small armies for U.S. interests. I was working for oil companies. I was doing arms deals from Eastern Europe to Africa. I helped prevent a genocide in the Rwanda region. A lot of the stuff that you would think that would be CIA or Special Operations Forces, I was doing as a private contractor. And I saw a new world of war that is is unusual. If you're a vet, it would be astounding and even alarming. And that's how kind of set this whole book and my PhD, et cetera, in motion, is like I was seeing things I felt very disturbed about, wanted to think about them deeply, and that's why I pursued education. And what I saw was a new way of warfare that was emerging around the world. This is like 15 years ago, and now we're seeing it in Yemen and Iraq and Syria, and it totally influenced this book, The New Rules of War, because I was seeing things that nobody else really had been seeing much, at least in the U.S.
Well, I think that's really important on a couple of fronts. First is, you know, a lot of times we see somebody who's successful like you are, has written novels and books and in the academic world, and we think, well, everything was on easy street for this guy. but you actually walked away from Harvard and said, this isn't for me, went out for 3 years into the private military contractor role, and then said, geez, maybe I ought to go back to work on my academics. So that must have been you must have shocked the heck out of a lot of your friends and family when you walked away from your education to go do this risky thing in Africa.
Yeah, they thought I was insane. I mean, there's no question about it. But, you know, I learned, life, as they say, life is what happens when you're making other plans. And my path has not been a linear straight path at all. And it's been really frustrating for me, but this sounds like a cliche, but really every step was indispensable. I mean, I went down some dark alleys and had a lot of frustrations and disappointments, but when I wrote this book and I do other things now, all those things it's all baked in there. It all matters. And when I talk to young people, whether I'm a professor at Georgetown talking to 20-somethings, or I go back to Fort Bragg or whatever, you know, people, I tell this to them, I don't disguise it. I don't say, oh, it was all easy, it was all meant to be, I plan to do that. That's mostly, you know, Bravo Sierra. What I did is I bounced around and I found my way, and I was true to what I wanted to do, and it kind of worked out in the end. Although if you had told me that as a young man, I would have maybe been skeptical.
Well, and I think it's important for people to be that honest, to say, yeah, life isn't linear. It took a lot of zigzagging paths, but they were all important. Yeah, and sometimes there were dark times that I had to work my way through, or I walked away from things that people thought I was, you know, ripping up my future on. Because I think we all have those situations. We just have to remember everybody else has them too, and if you stay the course, you'll get your way through. One of the things I found very well done in The New Rules of War, Victory in the Age of Durable Disorder, is a very readable book. And I say that as a compliment to an academic, a guy with a PhD, because sometimes you pick these up and go, oh, crap, I'll never get through this. This is very interesting. Let's start with what you mean by durable disorder.
Right. So durable disorder is the world we're walking into. So when we think about the world order historically, we think about nation states and they fight wars with big militaries. Think of World War II. And in the past 25 years, that world is retreating. Most nation states are failing. There is big vacuums in the world. This is where vets go to, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. That's the future. The future is disordered. It's not anarchy. It's not the sky is falling, invest in more sky. It's a new type of world order that's taking over that can contain problems but not solve them. And the signs of durable disorder are chaos and persistent conflict, like forever wars. And the problem is that strategists in Washington and London and other places, they're still thinking in terms of World War II. And war has moved on. I think our vets know this, especially ones who've, you know, been on the ground in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, that the old rules of war, our old weapon systems don't work. And we have to update that. And I get this feedback not just from me doing it myself, but at the National Defense University, my students are senior, you know, they're field grade officers, and they're coming back from tours all over the world and international students, other colonels from other countries, and they also tell me this. So this book really is about how do you win wars in this new environment, the durable disorder environment.
And you've put forth 10 rules. We're not going to be able to talk about all of them, but a few of them I want to explore. Rule 1's conventional war is dead. Rule 2 is technology will not save us. Very interesting chapter. Rule 3, there is no such thing as war or peace. Both coexist always. Rule 4 is hearts and minds do not matter. I want to stop here for a moment because this is, you explore the whole idea of counterinsurgency or COIN, and certainly some of your mentors when you were in made their living on promoting COIN. Talk to us a little bit about why hearts and minds do not matter.
Well, sure. I mean, I'll back up a little bit and say that these are 10 new rules of war that is intended to increase everybody's sort of strategic IQ, if you will. And the first four rules are about disbanding bad ideas in people, in our heads, right? Like things that we learn, like conventional war and stuff like that. So the first four is like how to stop thinking. The next, you know, six rules are like what to start thinking. And the biggest one is counterinsurgency. And we love, you know, like David Petraeus, you know, he promoted counterinsurgency. And what I found after, you know, he told me to go out and think about counterinsurgency, so I come back having studied it and having done it, that it doesn't really work that well. And the reason it doesn't work that well is because populations are not bribable. You can't, you know, imagine this. China goes to Detroit and says to people in Detroit, look, we'll give you free health care, free education, food, and we'll build you a new football stadium. And we want you to go communist. Now, people in Detroit would be like, we'll take all your stuff, but we ain't going to go communist. And that's the issue in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. People are happy to take your stuff, but it doesn't mean that they're going to become democracies or whatever. And the other some other reasons too is that the whole model of counterinsurgency actually comes from colonial France. It comes from how the French Empire was going to put down indigenous rebellions and reestablish colonial rule, which is fundamentally not compatible with democracy and nation building. It's a strange model that we chose, but that's the model we did.
But you go further and say America should consider a foreign legion to defuse counterinsurgency or insurgency issues before they arrived. So expand on that thought a little bit.
So this is really weird. So America. So this book doesn't just, you know, say here are problems, think about them. This is here are problems. Here are some solutions, and some of them are very outside the box, to use a cliche, right? One of them is a foreign legion. Now, when people think about foreign legions, they think of bad Claude Van Damme movies, right? They think of mercenaries. That's not, you know, French Foreign Legion, but that's not what the French Foreign Legion is. The French Foreign Legion is a unit in the French army. It is run by French officers. It runs by using French doctrine. It answers only to Paris. It's in their military chain of command. The only thing that's different about the French Foreign Legion and other units of the French army is that the French Foreign Legion, the enlisted, come from all over the world. And also the French Foreign Legion is used in a different way. I ran into the French Foreign Legion when I was working in Africa as a contractor, and they are pretty hardcore. What they do is they kind of like they have the punch of a special forces unit, but they have the staying power of a general purposes unit. And what the Foreign Legion can do is they can do innovative things that normally like our Marines and Army and so forth generally are not allowed to do. And you can put them into zones of durable disorder that we have a long-term interest in, say like Iraq or Syria, and they can stay there for a long time and not have to like rotate every 6 months, which creates all sorts of problems. Nor do we have to rely on contractors. You know, hiring private military contractors has a whole host of challenges. Anybody who knows Blackwater and Eric Prince knows that. And proxy militias like the Kurds and others, they're not reliable. I mean, they fight for their own cause. So if an American Foreign Legion gives us a footprint in zones of disorder, but we can control it, and they're there long term.
Well,
so that is, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I want to remind our listeners we're talking to Sean McFade, who wrote The New Rules of War, And there are 10 of them here, and I want to go to the next couple. I think the Foreign Legion idea is interesting, but the one I really want to get to is, so Rule 5 is the best weapons do not fire bullets. Rule 6 is mercenaries will return. You have a fascinating discussion on the role of mercenaries in the future. Can you explore that a little bit more?
Sure. So we think of mercenaries as villains, like from Hollywood, and that they should not be a part of war. And whether that's true or not is debatable. I'll say this about mercenaries. They are the second oldest profession. They are most of military history is privatized. It's mostly done by mercenaries from the Romans to the Middle Ages to, you know, up to recently, including our own revolution. Great Britain hired German mercenaries to fight the colonialists. They only went underground into the 1850s. And now they're coming back, and it's only 150 years. It's not that long. But they are coming back, and we're seeing them rise everywhere. We're seeing mercenaries always in the shadows, but they're in Ukraine and Iraq and Syria and Yemen and Nigeria. Any place there's a conflict market, you'll see them, and they are really hardcore. They are. You can rent special operations units. You can rent Mi-24 attack hind helicopters. They do all sorts of things, and this is coming back into war. And what that's doing now, it's changing warfare as we know it. It's turning, like, now we're having military strategies blend with market ones, and we're not ready for that.
And that sort of leads to rule, and I'll run through 7, 8, 9, and 10 quickly and back you up to 7 for a moment. Rule 7 is the new types of war powers will rule. Rule 8, there will be wars without states. Rule 9 is shadow wars will dominate. Rule 10 is victory is fungible. But you have an interesting discussion that kind of runs through Rule 7 and 8 about how it's just not nation states anymore. It might be corporations fighting wars. It might be churches, mega churches fighting wars. It might be billionaires fighting wars. Tell us how these ideas fit all together in your analysis.
Sure. So mercenaries are reemerging slowly, but they are definitely reemerging, and that trend is going to continue into the 21st century. Now, when you have now mercenaries out there, that allows the super rich to become a superpower. So anybody who wants to wage war can do so. So whether it's a Fortune 500 company or a random billionaire or, you know, oligarchs or drug lords or mega churches, anybody who has enough money and wants to wage a war can do so because the means of war are available. And supply and demand, supply being the mercenaries, demand being super rich people, will create wars without states. And this is already happening in places like Latin America, where you have cartels battling each other out. And states are no longer driving conflict. They're like war loot. We call them narco states. So Salvador, Guatemala, arguably Mexico, these are like they are prizes to be won in wars. They're not driving war. And this is what happened in the Middle Ages. This is what Machiavelli and others are talking about. It's like war is not – we were taught because we all – in sixth grade we learned that only states – can do international politics and only they can wage war. But for most of human history, that's not been the case. And that is what's going back. It's what's happening now is that war is being released from the control of states and it's going out to the wide world and there's a free market for force and that'll change everything.
And really the impact here, Sean, is that if the United States government doesn't rethink these issues, then it goes about solving these problems in a way that can't result in success, can't result in victory. They're fighting the wrong entities or ideologies. Do you feel that the current thinking in Washington, D.C. is beginning to head in the right direction, or are we just still fighting World War II?
We are still fighting World War II. And when people in Washington think about the future of war, to them it's World War II with better technology. So, for example, we're spending, the F-35 fighter jet, right? This This weapons program costs $1.5 trillion. That's like more money than Russia's GDP. And in two long wars, it fought zero combat missions. Two long wars, zero combat missions. The worth of any weapon is its utility, right? This dog don't hunt, as they say.
Right.
And we're still investing in a lot more. Now, here's the problem. So this is the mentality, is that we, the U.S., the Pentagon, expects that there might be a war against China, and it'll be in the South China Sea, and they're imagining, like, the Battle of Midway with F-35s. Meanwhile, China is winning the South China Sea without any aircraft carriers. And so what's going on? And that's why I wrote this book. I mean, I wrote this book because the U.S. has not won a war since 1945, to be honest, if we're honest with ourselves. It's not just the U.S., it's the West, like Europe, NATO. Nobody's won a war since 45. Yet we have the best military, we have the best troops, we have the best equipment, we have the best technology, we have the most money. So what's the problem? That's the puzzle I wanted to try to figure out with this book. And the problem is not with our troops or technology. The problem is the way we think about strategy. The problem is our strategic IQ is low. We have strategic atrophy. And that's, we have to think about, how is China winning the South China Sea? How is Russia winning Ukraine and Crimea? How are, and what they're doing, like you look at Iran, you could look at ISIS, what they're doing, they're fighting with new ways of war, new rules of war. And that's why I want to expose, but our military leadership, I'm not just talking to generals, I'm really talking about politicians and everybody else, they're kind of still stuck in the past. And I want to move us forward so we don't have more of these forever wars where we, you know, invest trillions of dollars, we lose friends in wars, and we make the situation worse on the ground, see our national image tarnished to lower level foes. It's unacceptable. And that's why I wrote the book.
Well, I think it's an extremely important book for not only those in the military or veterans and friends, but as you say, politicians to think about it. I would argue for the media to think about how they're going to define a future war or conflicts, how they're going to help define or shape the country's view of what success looks like and what is and isn't acceptable behavior. You know, I can hear the howling now over the concept of foreign legions or mercenaries, but I also read that portion of the book and said, oh my God, this makes so much sense. This is the first time I've read this from somebody. And as I said at the outset, this is a very readable book, so I'd encourage our veteran radio listeners to go out and buy The Rules of War by Sean McFate. It's very readable, and you're going to end up taking this William Morrow print and passing it around to your friends, because you're going to say, hey, this is a book you should read and can read. One question as we come to the end here, Sean. You've studied war throughout history. Is it simply silly to hope for or expect a time where there's just peace and prosperity, or is war just simply too hardwired into human nature?
Well, that's a question for the ages. I think that war is a part of the human condition. Nobody should want to go to war, but if you're going to go to war, you should fight it as efficiently as possible to save lives, to save treasure, to save everything. And that's, again, why I wrote the book, because war has moved on and we have to move with it. And if we want to fight wars, if we want to have stability, then we need to know how to employ our military in a way that is smart and doesn't get people needlessly harmed.
Well, this is both a fascinating and a disturbing book. It's rare that you can put those adjectives together here, but that's, I think, really sums it up and makes it maybe worth reading. Sean, if people want to know more about your thinking or follow along with you or find some of your other work, do you have a website that you want to direct them to?
Yeah, you can find me at seanmcfate.com, Sean, S-E-A-N, mcfate.com. And I do answer my emails. There's an email link there, and I invite everybody to join the revolution.
Well, it's a great book. It's a great read. I encourage it to our veteran radio listeners. And, Sean, I want to thank you for taking a little time to spread your ideas to our veteran radio listeners.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Appreciate it. It's meant to be a provocative book. So I want people to think about it. And it's meant to be written, read by, like, presidential candidates, but also, like, neighbors next door.
Yep.
And I think
yep.
we need to have a national discussion. It's not just me. It's a lot of other people who are thinking the same thing. I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, I've been thinking this too.
Hopefully you found that as fascinating as I did when talking with Sean McFate. We try to bring you new ideas here on Veteran Radio, maybe new stories, things you haven't thought about. If you've got any story ideas, you have somebody we should talk to, feel free to reach out to us on our website, veteransradio.net. Certainly on our Facebook, you can messenger us as well. You can send ideas to Dale at veteransradio.net or Jim at veteransradio.net. We're always interested in what you think might be a good topic to explore here on Veterans Radio. We publish our podcast every Tuesday at 11 a.m., so you can hear the latest there after listening here on Sunday on WHAM 1600 a.m. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.